There exist, I told you there exist some supergravity solutions that display a black-green horizon, so it has topology S1 plus S2. We also saw that a way to summarize those configurations in terms of the constituent brains was this one here in the M-theory description. The solutions depend on three charges, Q1, Q2, and Q3, which are conserved, and three dipoles, little Q1, 2, and 3, which are not conserved. And also one extra parameter, namely the radius of the ring, or if you wish, you can choose any other one. In particular, we will choose J psi, which was the angular momentum in the plane of the ring. And we also noticed that there is an angular momentum in the plane orthogonal to the ring. OK? I also wrote down the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of these black ring solutions in terms of the big Qs, little Qs, and J psi. So let me start by clarifying something that I was asked about last time, which is very simple, but probably I didn't make it completely clear. I was asked if there exist black ring solutions with only two dipoles. So what happens if you set one of the dipoles to zero? The answer is there are no regular solutions. And the way to see it is simply take this formula, substitute this value of J psi, and then set, for example, little q3 to 0. And you'll see that you get 2 pi square root of something that's manifestly negative. So what happens is that the area goes to 0 actually before q3 reaches 0. OK? So there are no supersymmetric black ring solutions with a finite area, regular horizon, unless all of the three dipoles are non-zero. OK. Now, another thing we noticed is that, and which follows from what I just reviewed, is that if you choose as your independent parameters the big Qs, the little Qs, and J psi, then the second angular momentum in the plane orthogonal to the ring is not an independent parameter. And my goal in this lecture is to convince you that this second angular momentum is not carried by the microscopic constituents of the ring, namely by this system. It is a property that's external to the ring. It's created by the supergravity fields. And I will be much more precise about that, but that's the goal in this lecture. And in particular, we'll count the entropy by counting microstates that have no J phi. So I'm not asking you to take my word for it, just to suspend your judgment. And then we'll see if it's reasonable at the end. So if I want to claim that J phi is not carried by the microscopic constituents, where is it coming from? The first hint comes from looking at the infinite radius limit of the ring. So suppose you start with one of those black ring solutions, and you wish to take R to infinity. What happens in this case is that the ring becomes, in that limit, an infinite string. So you stay at a finite distance from the ring, and you send the radius to infinity. So it looks straighter and straighter. And in the limit, it just becomes a straight string, a black string. Of course, in that limit, you have to keep qi over r fixed. Because remember, these qis are really densities of membranes around the ring. The membranes do not wrap the ring direction. They are distributed along the ring. So if you want to keep a finite charge density in the limit, you have to keep that ratio fixed. And you also have to keep the little qi's fixed, because the little qi's measure the number of fibrains along that direction. They are extended along that direction. So it turns out that if you do that, of course, the angular momentum in the plane of the ring, J psi, just becomes linear momentum. OK? So J psi becomes P along the string. And the surprising fact is that if you do the calculation, J phi in this limit goes to 0. So we see that J phi is a property of the ring of the supergravity solution that depends on whether the circle is really a circle that closes over itself, or whether it's a straight line. Now, if J phi was a property of the microscopic excitations on the ring that that give rise to entropy, why would it disappear? Why would it care whether I close the circle over itself or whether it's an infinite straight line? After all, intrinsically, a circle in space is the same as a periodically identified linear coordinate. I hope we all agree on that. OK. Good question. No. Because imagine, in fact, I'm glad you asked that because I was meant to make a comment here. Imagine that when we obtain this limit, j phi did not go to 0. Let's suppose that happened. Then once I have a straight string, I can periodically identify, because this is an isometry, I can periodically identify that direction. So let's suppose we had a j phi here. And once I've done that, I'm free to dimensionally reduce this solution along that direction down to 4 dimensions. And what I would obtain is a supersymmetric, because this is a limit of a supersymmetric solution, rotating black hole with a finite area horizon and a regular horizon. And I just told you the first day that because of the uniqueness theorems, we know there is no such a thing. So this is just as well, because otherwise I would have reached a contradiction with the four-dimensional theorems. So this had to happen. Now, my proposal is that J phi is a property associated to extrinsic features of the solution, not to the intrinsic microscopic constituents. So let me make that more precise. The statement is that J phi is generated by crossed electric and magnetic supergravity fields. To explain that, let me remind you of the following fact. You know that the membranes, the M2 branes, are electric sources for the supergravity potential, the free-form supergravity potential, in 11 dimensions. Why? Because the membrane has a 2+1 dimensional Bohr volume. So it couples minimally to the free-form in 11 dimensions. So it's an electric source. The field strength D of A3 is a 4-form. And if you dualize, you Hodge dualize to go to the magnetic variables, then that comes from a 7-form. That's a Hodge dual of F4. 4+7 is 11. And this comes from a gauge potential, A6, I should say, which is the magnetic dual of A3. And A6 couples minimally to the 5-brain. So the 5-brain is an electric source for the dual of A3, or equivalently, a magnetic source for A3. So the membrane sources the electric components of A3, and the 5-brain sources the magnetic components of A3. And that means that in this system, because we have membranes and 5-brains present at the same time, there will be electric and magnetic fields in the supergravity solution, which will generate, through their cross product, J phi. That is the claim. So J phi, schematically, and I'll be much more precise about this later, but schematically, J phi is something like, in quotation marks, the cross product between the electric components of A3 and the magnetic components of A3. Now, if this is to be true, then we should be able to see that this cross product vanishes precisely in the case in which the cross section of the ring is a straight line, and that it doesn't vanish when you bend the cross section to form a circle. That's the first consistency check. And that is indeed true. You can show, just based on the symmetries of the problem, that if you have, if the M2 brains, they're always straight, but if the 5-brain, if the 5-brains are a straight line, so if this psi parametrizes a straight line, then you can show that that cross product E cross B is identically 0. And that is because the fields, the electric and magnetic components that these brains source are aligned. In this case, you can show that they point, so to speak, in the same direction. However, if you now bend the cross-section of the phi brain to curve it over itself and form a circle, then these fields become misaligned. And their cross product no longer vanishes. And that will generate a non-zero J phi. That is the idea. Let me give you an analogy of this in four dimensions that you will be much more familiar with. So suppose you could construct in four dimensions a solution that has two black holes in it, one black hole over here and another black hole over here. And I will actually give you an example of this. And suppose the first black hole carries electric charge, Q electric, and the second one carries magnetic charge. In that case, there will be this solution. If you go to infinity, you will measure a non-zero angular momentum because of the crossed electric and magnetic fields. Unless, so this situation is the analog of this one. When does this angular momentum vanish? It vanishes if I take the two black holes and I exactly superpose them on top of each other. Because if I do that, the electric and magnetic fields will become aligned, and E cross B will be zero. Is that clear? Any questions so far? OK. So that's the idea. And now let's see if we can count the entropy of this black ring using a microscopic description. And in particular, if we can count it, if we see any trace of J phi. OK, so in order to do that, what we have to do is to find, if you like, a microscopic description of this system, a Wahr volume description of this system, some rough analog of the description I gave you the first day for the two-charge supertube in which you have a D2 brain in which the strings and the D0 brains are dissolved. That's what we are after. So in order to construct that, let's for a second forget about the membranes. Let's concentrate on the phi brains, and then we'll see how we incorporate the membranes. So let's start by considering 3 M5s along those directions. So let me copy that over here. 3, 4, 5, 6. One, two, five, six. And 1, 2, 3, 4. And for the sake of simplicity, let's start by considering the overall direction over which the phi brains intersect. Let's take that for the moment to be a straight line, and we'll see how we modify that. But for the moment, let's just write it as the 7th direction. And let's assume it's a straight line. And remember, these 6 directions over here, we are assuming they are compactified on a 6 torus. So if I want to find a description of this system that allows me to count the microstates, first of all, I have to desingularize this intersection. What I mean by that is that over here, the three five frames intersect. If you notice, pairwise, they intersect over two planes. And all of them, if I suppress the seventh direction, intersect over a point. So at these intersections, the five-ring wall volume is not a smooth manifold. It's singular. Is that clear? So what we'd like to do is to find a description that is smooth. Namely, we want to deform this picture into the following. If you notice here, the five rings, each of them wraps a four cycle inside the T6. And these four cycles intersect singularly with each other. However, it is well known that in this situation, if you take a single M5 ring and you wrap it on any four cycle in the T6, as long as that four cycle is holomorphic, namely it is embedded, it is a complex submanifold of T6, as long as that's the case, that five ring preserves supersymmetry. So the desingularization of this wrap array over here consists of a single five ring, which I will draw pictorically like this. This is supposed to be a complex surface of complex dimension 2, namely real dimension 4. Complex dimensional surface inside T6. So what I'm saying is that the smooth configurations that describe this system are five rings wrapped on such a holomorphic surface across the seventh direction. And what I'm claiming is that as long as this four cycle is holomorphically embedded in T6, this preserves supersymmetry, and in fact preserves the same supersymmetries as indicated by this array. It preserves 1/8 supersymmetry. Okay? So for each choice of holomorphic two surface, you get, so to speak, a microstate of the black ring. Sorry, a microstate of this system that has no membranes yet. Okay, any questions about that? Now what we'd like to do is to see how we incorporate the membranes to build up the black ring, and how that will allow us to replace this with an arbitrary curve. So now, remember in the two-charge case, what we did to stabilize the arbitrary cross-section of the D2 brain was to add fluxes in the D2 brain that represented the dissolved charges. So here we would like to do the same. And I'm not going to prove it, but you can show that for any choice of real dimensional four surface, there is a corresponding choice of the wall volume two form that lives on the five ring. Let me remind you about this. Just like for D brains, on the wall volume there is a U1 gauge field. On the five ring there is also a U1 gauge field that happens to be a two form. That's not too important. The state, what's important is that you can turn on electric and magnetic fluxes on the wall volume of the five ring that will generate a linear momentum along this direction. Remember, this is just a pointing linear momentum that we saw is generated on the D2 brain when you dissolve these electric and magnetic fluxes. And once you have that linear momentum, that allows you to replace the seventh direction over here by an arbitrary curve C, which is stabilized by the fact that there is a linear momentum density going around it. So this is exactly, I'm repeating more or less the story that we did for the two charge case. And of course, once you turn on these electric and magnetic fluxes, they correspond to dissolved membranes on the five brain. So now, if you turn them on appropriately, this system, this five ring, will also carry membrane charge
sorry.
And in fact, if you choose now the cross-section C, which you can choose arbitrarily, if you choose it to be a closed curve, a closed contractible curve, then there will be no net M5 rain charge anymore. Because remember, if a 5 rain wraps a contractible cross-section, just like a D2 rain, it carries no net charge. It carries dipoles, but it doesn't carry a net charge. So now, once I do that, I'm going to replace these big M's by little M's to indicate that now this system doesn't carry any net M5 rain charge. So if you notice, this is exactly what we wanted to achieve. We wanted a system that only carries membrane charge and that has M5 rains in it that source some dipole fields, but no net charges. And moreover, we wanted the cross-section to be a circle. So in particular, we can choose this cross-section to be a closed circle, contractible circle in space-time. And notice that because there is this linear momentum, P, which is just the cross product of these fluxes going around the circle, this means, so let's call this direction around the circle psi. This means that if you choose a circle to lie in a given two-plane with polar angle psi, then there will be a net j psi. But there is no trace of anything that's sourcing or giving rise to an angular momentum in the plane orthogonal to the cross-section. So we see that from the microscopic point of view, there is no trace of J phi. Is that clear? OK. So to test this proposal, let's see if we can use this description to count the entropy microscopically and reproduce that formula that I wrote down for the entropy, for the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy on the other blackboard. Any questions so far? OK. Let me emphasize that even though here we don't see any trace of J phi, this picture, this description does capture the three net charges and the three dipoles. They're all apparent and manifest in the system. OK. So it turns out that in order to count to use this description to count the entropy of the black ring, we hardly have to do any work. It was all done for us, essentially, by Maldacena, Strominger, and Witten. So what I'd like to do in the next 5 minutes is tell you what they did. And then in the next minute, I'll tell you how you slightly modify it to apply it to our case and obtain that formula. So what did they do? They were interested in counting the entropy of four-dimensional black holes, not five-dimensional black rings, but four-dimensional black holes. And they wanted to use M-theory to do that. So what they did is to consider M-theory compactified on T6 cross S1. And then, of course, the rest of the dimensions are non-compact. So you have R13 over here. OK, so you compactify M theory from 11 down to 4 dimensions. And how do you build a 4-dimensional black hole in this compactification? Well, all you have to do is take an M5 brain wrapped on a 4-cycle on the T6. So you're going to see that it's almost analogous to what we are doing here. They consider an M5 wrapped on a 4-cycle here. So this is a holomorphic 4-cycle. And you also need to add membrane charge. Well, you're not forced to, but in the general case, in the general 4-dimensional black hole, it can carry those charges. So they add some fluxes, just like we did here, on the holomorphic 4-cycle to induce membrane charge. Of course, the FiveBrain has a five-dimensional world space. So you wrap four of its dimensions over here, and then the extra one, you wrap it on the circle. And once you have done that, this FiveBrain is completely wrapped on the internal manifold. And therefore, from the point of view of an observer in four dimensions, it looks point-like, which is precisely what you wanted. You want to construct an object that is point-like, or more precisely, spherical. So what you construct by this method is a four-dimensional black hole that has a two-sphere horizon. So it's localized. And from this point of view, you don't see any of the internal dimensions of the FiveBrain. Now, how do you obtain the entropy of this black hole? Well, you have to count microstates. And then counting microstates means counting how many different ways. Sorry, I forgot to mention that there is also momentum going around that circle. So you have to count how many different ways there are of wrapping a FiveBrain with given charges on a holomorphic four cycle inside T6. It's basically a geometric counting. It becomes a problem in algebraic geometry, if you like. Now, the clever way of doing that is the following. You take the M5-brain action, which is some, it looks like a Dirac-Bourne infield action. You take that action, and you do a Kaluza-Klein reduction down to the S1. So because this holomorphic four cycle is a compact finite volume cycle, you can just Kaluza-Klein reduce, namely expand all your fields in harmonics in this four cycle, and reduce that, the effective action. So you Kaluza-Klein reduce, and you obtain an effective theory on the S1 for the massless modes. So these massless modes describe deformations. They are massless because it costs no energy to excite them. And they describe deformations of this surface inside the T6 that don't cost any energy. The reason you want to do that is because you want to count BPS states. So what you obtain is some two-dimensional supersymmetric conformal field theory that has right-moving supersymmetry, but no left-moving supersymmetry, with a given central charge that you can compute, and this is what they did. So this has a central charge in the left-moving sector that's given by 6 times Q1, Q2, Q3, where, remember, these Qs measure the wrappings of the FiveBrains on the internal cycles. Or if you like, they characterize the FiveBrain dipoles. So once you have this central charge, then all you have to do to count states is apply Cardy's formula to this two-dimensional CFT. Once you have a CFT in two dimensions, if somebody asks you what is the number of states at a given oscillator level, that's given by Cardy's formula, which I'm just going to write down. Yes, strictly speaking, yes. So in order for this counting to be justified, you have to make sure that this FiveBrain is everywhere smooth, because if it's not, then you have to take into account corrections to the low energy effective action. And also you have to ensure that the generic configuration doesn't self-intersect, for example, or doesn't overlap. Because if it does, then you have to take into account non-abelian corrections. And they prove that under certain conditions on the charges, essentially that the charges are large, it can be more precise, but roughly speaking, that's the condition, then the generic configuration is like that, satisfies those requirements. So the entropy comes from the generic configuration, and for that one, this approach is justified. Yes? Yeah, it's just a... So before you take into account the back reaction, gravity, it looks like a point. Because this is a five-brain. If you take a compactification of M-theory and you take a five-brain and you wrap it completely on the internal directions, from the point of view of the non-compact directions, it looks like a point-like particle that has some mass. And the point is that if this charge, if you have enough non-zero charges, that particle has some mass that will generate a horizon around it. So it will look like a black hole in four dimensions. Just a second. So here you get a black hole. And of course, the charges of this black hole are completely determined by the way in which you wrap the fibrin on the internal directions. Well, that you can see from the fact that this theory up here has 0.2 supersymmetry in six dimensions. The fibrin, the low energy dynamics on the fibrin is described by a 0.2 six-dimensional superconformal field theory. So if you take that theory and you compactify it down to two dimensions, remember that this fibrin, when you wrap it on the T6, breaks 1/8 supersymmetry. So if you do the counting, you get the chirality is inherited from the chirality of the high-dimensional theory, and the number of supersymmetries just comes from counting the unbroken ones. Okay, so I was going to write down here the Cardy's formula, and then we're almost done. So Cardy's formula says that the entropy is 2 pi times the square root of the central charge divided by 6 times something that I'm going to call Q naught hat. This Q has nothing to do with the dipoles. Okay? It's just a number. So this is the central charge. And this is the oscillator level. Now, you might have thought that the oscillator level is just the momentum going around the circle, but that is not true. In fact, the non-trivial calculation of the microscopic entropy is, on the one hand, determining the central charge, and really the rather non-trivial part is determining how this oscillator level is related to the total momentum and to the membrane charges that you have dissolved in the fibrin. So let me write down the formula that Maldacena, Strominger, and Witten computed, and then tell you where each term comes from. So this Q0 hat is given by P, the momentum around the S1, plus 1/2 of Q1, Q2 divided by Q3, plus Q2, Q3, divided by Q1 plus Q1, Q3 divided by Q2 minus 3 over twice the central charge times Q1 little Q1 squared plus Q2 little Q2 squared plus Q3 little Q3 squared plus the central charge divided by 24. Okay. So this term here, that's a shift in the momentum of the ground state in this CFT induced by the fact that this is not just a fibrin, but it's a fibrin with membrane charge dissolved on it. This should not be surprising at all to you, Because remember that this is precisely the supertube mechanism. If you take a high-dimensional brain and you dissolve lower-dimensional charges in it by turning on electric and magnetic fluxes, that induces a momentum around the circle. In other words, dissolving those fluxes shifts the momentum of the ground state of this two-dimensional CFT. Okay? So, of course, you might not have guessed the precise expression, but that's the physical origin of that term. Yes, this black hole can carry a number of charges, some of them electric, some of them magnetic, from the point of view of the four dimensions. And those charges are determined by the total amount of momentum around the circle, and by the number of fibrins, and by the number of membranes. I'll get to that. Let me finish the description of what they did, and then we'll see how we modify it. Okay, so this is an M2 induced shift of the momentum. And this one here is just a zero energy, zero point shift. So I should say that every single calculation of the microscopic entropy of a black hole that matches the macroscopic Bekenstein-Hawking entropy in string theory that I am aware of uses Cardy's formula. So every single calculation can be reduced to a calculation of the number of microstates in a two-dimensional CFT. And all of those calculations are done using Cardy's formula. And from that point of view, what is somewhat non-trivial is finding out, of course, the central charge, but more specifically, what is the oscillator level in terms of the conserved charges, in terms of the total momentum and the membrane charges and the fibrin charges. Just a second. Let me emphasize that in this construction over here for the four-dimensional black hole, these little Qs are conserved charges. And the reason for that is that the fiber in this case is wrapped on a topologically non-trivial cycle in space-time. Okay? So this cycle, this circle here, this S1, when you construct these black holes, is a non-contractible cycle, is a non-contractible circle, and the fiber is wrapped on it. So from the point of view of the four-dimensional black hole, those charges are conserved, those little Qs. I hope that's not confusing, because that will not be the case for the black ring. Now we'll see why. Somebody had a question? Yes, they are just, they just count winding numbers. The small Qs as well. Yes, because they tell you how many times the membranes or the fibrins are wrapped on each of the cycles of the six torus. So they just have to do with the cohomology of the internal space. So this can be done in general for a Calabi-Yau manifold, and then you obtain an entropy that's a function of the Hodge numbers of the Calabi-Yau and of the cycles wrapped by the fibrin. It's an electric charge. It's an electric charge because remember, imagine you take a theories. Okay, so this is something that Samir has been using extensively and you didn't ask him. But I'm just kidding. So imagine you take, I don't know where to erase. Let me erase this for a second. If you take a theory in five dimensions, So let's look just at this bit. Imagine you're reducing from 5 to 4 dimensions. And you have a metric, g mu nu, in 5 dimensions. When you reduce, this will give you a metric. So let me g mu nu. This will give you gij. It will give you a vector, gi5, and a scalar, g5, 5. So if you put momentum p around the fifth direction, okay, that corresponds, one way to understand that is when you go to infinity, there is a cross term in the metric, dt dx5. But when you reduce, that becomes, this is ai, right? So that becomes an at, which is the electric part. So momentum in 5 dimensions becomes electric charge. OK, any more questions? Good. So let's see, what do we have to do then to get the entropy of the, yes? This system carries 7 charges. It carries 3 big Qs, 3 little Qs, and something that corresponds to the momentum in the fifth dimension. And from the point of view for the black hole, these are all conserved charges. This central charge is a number that measures the number of degrees of freedom in the CFT, in this two-dimensional conformal field theory. OK, so then it's very easy to see how we have to modify this picture. It's almost trivial to actually use this formula to compute the entropy of the black ring. Because what we want to do is to compactify M theory not down to 4, but down to 5 dimensions. OK? So what I'll do is to replace this. As Cyber was saying, this is back. Bad practice for the speaker, but you have all the notes, so let me not draw it again. So we want to reduce down to 5 dimensions. So what I want to do is to compactify only on T6. And still, I'm going to wrap the fibrae, as I told you over here. Now I'm just going to follow this intuition. I'm going to wrap the fibrae on a 4 cycle, just like we did over here. And then the extra direction of the fibrae will still be a circle, but it will not be wrapped on any non-contractible cycle. It will just be a circle a contractible one in 5 dimensions, which nevertheless is stabilized by the fact that there is a momentum, or more precisely, that there is an angular momentum j psi around it. That, of course, comes from the linear momentum. Is this clear? So if you notice, from the point of view of an excitation living on the fibrae, there is absolutely no difference whatsoever between this picture and the one we drew for the black hole. If you are an excitation living on the fibrae, all you see is that you can either move on the T6 on this 4 cycle, or that you're propagating on this S1. But you don't see if you're embedded wrapped around a contractible cycle or not. OK. So if that's the case, then this procedure that we did before can be exactly repeated, because all I was using was the starting point was the low energy effective action for a fibrae wrapped on a 4 cycle, which is still the case. So I can again Kaluza-Klein reduce down to a two-dimensional CFT that now lives on this circle, just like it did before. It's just that now this circle is embedded in a contractible way in spacetime. That is the only difference. Any questions about that? Because that is the key point. Okay. So now, if you believe that, all we have to do is apply this formula. But in order to do that, we have to know what this total momentum is in terms of the charges that the black ring carries. The black ring now doesn't carry a net linear momentum, because this momentum is going around an S1 that's contractible. So it only gives rise to angular momentum. But the net linear momentum, when you integrate, you get zero. Now, this J psi and this P are both integrally quantized. So what we have to do then is to identify P with J psi. After all, they both have the same origin, and they are both integrally quantized. And the only ambiguity is the sign. And the sign you have to choose is a minus sign. This might be at this point, this is just a sign. And it might be a little bit surprising. But I will give you some more explanation of why you have to choose a minus sign. But if you do, if you choose this identification, and you replace this expression here. If you set P, so if you replace that by minus J psi, and you take this expression, substitute it over here, and multiply by the central charge divided by 6, you get exactly this formula. Yes. Yes. At the level of the war volume of the microscopic theory living on the ring, that is the only effect. Roughly speaking, there are some subtleties that I can discuss with you in private, but I don't want to get into it now here. But that's pretty much the story. Yes. Good, so thank you for asking that. I should emphasize first that unlike in the black hole case, in this case, the little q's are not conserved because they are now dipoles. And of course, the origin is that this circle is contractible, okay? So if you want to go from one configuration, as you're asking, with a given set of little q's to another one, what you have to do is to contract, take one of the five rings, contract it down to a point, and then expand it. So this is something that's hard to picture because it's going on at the same time over here and over here. But basically, you have to go through that point and then. So you might ask whether, well, let me not say anything more about that. Is that, does that satisfy you? Okay. Yes. Yeah, okay. How do I see, sorry? The bound on J? Good. So one of the reasons why, so there are a certain number of aspects of the supergravity solution for the black ring that cannot be seen from the microscopic point of view. The most striking one is J phi. There's no J phi in the microscopic description, right? Another one is the fact that if you remember, I told you that, for example, the Q1 has to be greater or equal than Q2, Q3. etc., that bound cannot be seen either from this description. And I haven't thought about the one on Jabe's side, but I believe, I'm not sure you would be able to see it. No, it's not a contradiction in the sense that Jabe's side has a contribution here that is equal to J5. So Jabe's side is the sum of two terms. This one plus something that's a supertube-like contribution. And I'm just arguing that this one cannot be seen from the microscopic point of view. So the contribution to the to Jabe's side probably cannot be seen either. But I'll be more precise about this in a few minutes. Any more questions? You mean at infinity? Yes. These J's are the AVM values of the yeah. Okay, so let me just, before I move on, emphasize that we have reproduced the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy with a microscopic calculation that's counting states that have no J phi. Okay? All these fluctuations that we are counting here correspond, most of them, in fact, the ones that give rise to the entropy, to fluctuations in the shape of the fibrin in the internal six torus. Okay, so they carry absolutely no J phi. And nevertheless, we are reproducing the correct entropy. Okay, so this might sound a little bit suspicious or mysterious, at least. This fact that J phi is not visible in the microscopic description. So let's ask the question of whether we can make more precise where exactly is this J phi located? Namely, what is the distribution of this J phi? And we'll ask the same question for J psi. And by asking that, we will actually discover something very interesting that hadn't been observed earlier. So let me erase over here. So you all know, probably, that in general relativity, the only quantities, the only conserved charges that you can talk about are charges measured at infinity. For example, there is no, for a general spacetime, there is no local definition of energy density or mass density. However, so that's true in general. But if you have symmetries, so if your spacetime has Killing vector fields, then it is possible to define local quantities. OK? And this is precisely what we want to do here, because we would like to see where in the black ring solution is this J phi and J psi. So in general, let's suppose, so this has to do with Comar integrals. OK, let's suppose that we have a Killing vector field K. And I will denote, so this is a Killing vector field. And I will denote by the same letter the corresponding dual one form. So this is a vector field. So it has its index upstairs. If you contract it with a metric, you can lower the index and you get a one form. So if this is a Killing vector field, then you can define something called a Comar integral that's given by an integral over the boundary of some volume. So you take a volume in spacetime, V, with a given boundary, and then you integrate the Hodge dual of D of K. This is called a Comar integral. And the physical interpretation of this integral is that it measures the amount of conserved charge conjugate to K in V. So imagine, for example, you have a spacetime that is time translation invariant. So you have a time-like Killing vector field, K, okay? Which in that case would just be, in some coordinate, adaptive coordinate system would be partial T. Then you take that and you lower its index. You compute a two-form by acting on it with a differential and Hodge dualize. And that you integrate over the boundary of a given volume. What that is measuring for you is the amount of mass or energy in that volume. If instead of a time-like Killing vector field, you take a translation Killing vector field, that integral measures the amount of linear momentum in that volume. If you take a rotational Killing vector, then that integral measures the total amount of angular momentum in a given volume. And this is precisely what we want to study. So what happens if we consider these integrals? And notice that this you can integrate over the boundary of any volume. So for any volume, you can ask how much of that charge is contained in that volume. So if you take the integral at infinity, what you're doing is you're measuring the total amount of charge in your spacetime. And that, of course, should coincide with the AVM value, for example, of the mass. So for the black ring, let's suppose we compute at infinity . So we have some black ring, and we take an S3 at infinity, and we compute. So this S3 at infinity is the boundary of space. So we are computing the total amount of angular momentum in space. If you compute this for the Killing vector field K psi, so that the one-form dual to rotations in the plane of the ring, what you get at infinity is minus j psi. Of course, notice that this integral is defined up to a constant. I'm free to normalize my definition of charge as I like. In particular, there is a sign ambiguity here. I could have chosen to define it with a minus sign, okay? So that sign is ambiguous, but you'll see that there's a relative sign that is not ambiguous. So with these conventions that I've chosen, this integral at infinity measures minus the total angular momentum, as you would expect. Up to a sign, it has to give you the total amount of angular momentum. And if you do it for the S3 at infinity, for the dual of the rotational symmetry in the plane orthogonal to the ring, you also get, as you would expect, minus j phi. So what I'm saying here is just that at infinity, you reproduce the ADM values, which is what you would expect. But now let's see what happens if we integrate the same quantities over an S1 cross S2 named at the horizon. Okay? So now I take a surface here, closer and closer to the horizon. And in fact, I take the horizon itself, which has topology, remember, S1 cross S2 at the horizon. And I compute the same quantity, this one. It turns out you get a different result. And what you get is precisely Q0 hat, which, remember, is the quantity that goes into the entropy. Okay, so if you look at your notes and you look at the expression of Q0 hat in terms of the charges, that is precisely what this integral computes for you at the horizon, which is a very complicated expression. So the interpretation is that the difference between these two integrals at infinity and at the horizon is the total amount of momentum, of angular momentum, outside the horizon. I hope that's clear. So this is saying that this integral, as you bring it in from infinity all the way down to the horizon, is computing for you, is doing for you, performing for you the calculation that is very non-trivial to perform sometimes in the microscopic CFT. Remember, in the microscopic CFT, this was just P. And I told you that the non-trivial part is determining what is Q naught hat in terms of P and the other conserved charges. And what I'm saying here is that this comma integral is a gravitational calculator that performs for you that calculation. And it turns out that this result is general and it's true for any supersymmetric black hole that I'm aware of. We have done the calculation for all of them, and in all cases, this integral calculated at the horizon measures the effective oscillator level that goes into Cardy's formula. Okay, and what happens if we do it for the other one? Well, if you do this integral at the horizon, can somebody give me a guess? Come on. It can only be 0, 1, or infinity. So it's 0. Meaning that all the angular momentum in the plane orthogonal to the ring is outside the horizon. So this is consistent with interpretation I'm suggesting, which is that this second quantum number is not associated to stuff behind the horizon. Good question. For supersymmetric black holes, you always get 0 if you compute that at the horizon. Now, you can wonder what the interpretation of that is. One possible interpretation is that that integral is measuring. So this integral here at the horizon, what that's measuring is the difference between the ground state momentum and the momentum of the states you want to count. So it's the difference between the two. For a supersymmetric black hole, the difference between the, it saturates a VPS bound, so the energy is given by the sum of the charges. However, I have to say that using comma integrals, pushing this interpretation too far is very tricky, and I don't want to do it, because there is even some controversy in general relativity about exactly what comma integrals mean. But I think for this case, the interpretation is clear for supersymmetric ones. For non-supersymmetric ones, I don't have much to say. So I don't want to overclaim anything, but this is what happens if you do the calculations. Good. So this result, well, it means the following. One thing that's a little bit unsatisfactory about black holes is that, for example, when you write the first law, some of the quantities that appear are measured at infinity, and some other ones are measured at the horizon. So that's a little bit of a mixed state of affairs, which you might find perhaps unsatisfactory. What this is saying is that to compute the entropy, now you only have to look at the horizon. You don't need to know anything about infinity. The reason is that I just told you a universal recipe for computing that. It's a comma integral at the horizon, right? And this one here, it turns out that for supersymmetric black holes, in fact, in general, this you can read off, this central charge, you can read it off from the near horizon limit of the black hole. So for all the black holes we know how to count the entropy of in string theory, the near horizon has a piece of BTC black hole in it, which is locally ADS3. So this central charge is given by 3 times the radius of the near horizon ADS3 factor divided by twice Newton's constant in 3 dimensions. So just by going near the horizon, you can now count the entropy. So this is a way of circumventing the somewhat sophisticated calculation of this object in terms of conserved charges that you measure at infinity. No, the explanation, in fact, this is not mysterious, because the explanation for why this is true is that the near horizon geometry of supersymmetric black holes is an extremal BTZ black hole. So if you use that information, you can actually prove that for any supersymmetric black hole that has the near horizon geometry, this formula is true. So it is kind of trivial from that point of view. What is non-trivial, in my opinion, is not so much that this integral at the horizon is measuring this quantity. That you can prove by knowing that the near horizon is BTZ. What is non-trivial is that the same integral is interpolating for you on the gravity side between this quantity and the total charge, the total momentum at infinity. At asymptotically flat infinity, not the boundary of ADS3. Any more questions? Yes. Yeah, so for BMPV, what you have to do is, BMPV is a rotating black hole in 5 dimensions. You have, but the only way we know how to count the entropy is by lifting it to 6 dimensions. And in that case, you get a string, a black string. And because you get a black string, the dual CFT is a 2-dimensional CFT for which you can apply Cardy's formula. And in that case, also, you compute this integral. In that case, the Killing symmetry you have to put in the integral is the momentum, the generator of translations, and you get the correct Q naught hat. This is the microcanonical ensemble. Does that answer your question? Yeah, but you take the log. It's an additive, isn't it? An additive constant that's subleading for large charges. Yeah, sorry. I should have probably emphasized that everything I'm saying here holds for large charges, which is the case in which you can look at the superiority solution. Yes. Sorry, say that again. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yes, the way you do that is somebody gives you a black ring, then you localize where the horizon is. And now you take an S2, something that's topologically an S2. It can be as weakly as you like. The only condition is that it links the horizon with linking number 1. So it just goes once around it, so you can't pull it out. Okay, it's linked. And then you compute a flux through that S2 of the corresponding field strength whose dipole moment you want to measure. And this gives you precisely the little Q. Yes. There are 3 because the effective theory that you get in 5 dimensions, this supergravity theory, in which the supersymmetric black ring lives, has 3 gauge fields. So you have 3 independent electric charges and 3 independent magnetic dipoles, which are the 3 little Qs. Any more questions? Good. So I have time to tell you about the connection to 4D black holes. So everything we've been saying concerns black rings in five dimensions. Black rings that are asymptotically flat in five dimensions. And because they are asymptotically flat in five dimensions, there is no finite everywhere finite size circle on which I can reduce the solution down to four dimensions to make contact with black holes in four dimensions. But we can also construct five-dimensional black rings that are not asymptotically flat, but that are asymptotic to Taubnat space. So, and that's what's going to allow us to make the connection. So let me tell you very quickly what Taubnat is. Euclidean Taubnat. So this will be, I guess, from black rings in five dimensions then to black holes in four dimensions. Okay, so what is Euclidean Taubnat? Euclidean Taubnat is an S1 vibration over R3. What does that mean? It means that it's a space that looks like this. There's an R3 base. And this is a four-dimensional space, which is constructed by putting a circle on top of each of the points on R3. There is an S1. OK, so over here, there's another one. Over here, there's another one. And over here, it contracts. So it's an S1 vibration. So as I said, on top of each point, there is an S1, whose radius varies as you move around the R3. And this S1, this is one over here, contracts to zero size, to a point, at the origin of R3. OK? But it contracts to zero size in a way it's non-trivially fibered over the angular coordinates of R3 in such a way that it contracts in a smooth way. So the whole space is topologically completely, is metrically completely smooth and topologically trivial. Topologically, Taubnat, four-dimensional Euclidean Taubnat, is just R4. But metrically, the S1 is non-trivially fibered over the base space, which is R3. And in fact, as you go to infinity, so when R goes to infinity, if you look at the size of the S1, it stabilizes. It attains a finite value, finite constant value at infinity. OK? So at infinity, at R going to infinity, where R is the radial coordinate in R3, Taubnat looks locally like R3 cross S1. OK? And this means that if we have some solution that is asymptotic to Taubnat space, we can Kaluza-Klein reduce on the circle, because it has a finite size at infinity, and reduce the solution down to four dimensions. OK. So it turns out that it's very easy to construct black ring solutions in which you take a black ring, and rather than placing it in flat space, what you do is you wrap the S1 of the black ring, you wrap it on the fiber of Taubnat. So it looks something like this. And the reason why this black ring doesn't contract and slip all the way down to the origin, because of course it would want to do that to minimize its area. The reason it doesn't do that is because, of course, it has angular momentum. Remember that there is a j psi, which you can think of as originating from linear momentum going around the circle. So that wants to prevent it from shrinking. So these solutions are easy to relatively easy to construct, and they are supersymmetric. And if you notice, once you have such a solution, if you dimensionally reduce down to four dimensions, what you get is a black hole with a two-sphere horizon. Why is that? Because I started with a black ring that has, let me erase this, and this black ring, remember, has a horizon that's S1 cross S2. And what I've done is to take the S1 and wrap it on the S1 of the fiber. So when I reduce, what that means is that I don't see the fiber anymore, and the only thing I see is the S2. So I get a black hole in four dimensions. Is that clear? Okay. Now, remember as well that the black ring carries, the supersymmetric one, carries two angular momenta. This one, because it's, you can think of it as momentum going along the ring, along the S1, and this comes back to Diego's question. Because this one you can think of as momentum on the S1, when you Kaluza-Klein reduce down to four dimensions, becomes electric charge. So this black hole here has an electric charge, Q electric, that's equal to P on the S1, that's equal to J psi. Is this clear? Okay. And of course, the J phi, which I don't know exactly how to draw, let me do it like this. The other component of the angular momentum becomes angular momentum in four dimensions. Actually, let me not draw it like this. Let me not do that, because I don't want to suggest that it's localized over here. All I want to say is that the J phi of the black ring in five dimensions becomes an angular momentum in four dimensions. Now, if you are now an observer in four dimensions, let's ask the question, where is this angular momentum in four dimensions coming from? It's not coming from this black hole. Because remember that I told you that there are no supersymmetric black holes that are rotating in four dimensions. So it cannot be associated to the black hole itself. So where is it coming from? Well, let's finalize the story. Remember that I told you that the S1 shrinks to zero size at the origin here. So what happens is that even though the five-dimensional solution is smooth everywhere because it shrinks in a smooth way, when you reduce down to four dimensions, from the four-dimensional point of view, you get a singularity. So there is a singularity over here. Let's put it with a, let's denote it with a cross. That's a singularity. And this singularity carries magnetic charge. Why is that? Let me justify that very quickly, because I see some surprise faces. So let's go back and see why this carries electric charge. Remember I told you that the component of the metric G mu 5, so the metric in five dimensions with one leg along the S1, becomes a gauge field in four dimensions. Okay? And of course, this is the reason why when you put momentum along the fifth direction, P along S1 means that the metric in five dimensions has a G0 5 component at infinity, Okay, that's what it means, that there is momentum along the fifth direction. You read it off from the metric at infinity. But this is simply a zero in four dimensions. And this is what is sourced by electric charge in four dimensions. Is that clear? OK. Now, why does this singularity carry magnetic charge then? Well, the reason is because I told you that the S1 is non-trivially fibered over the base space. What does it mean that it's non-trivially fibered? It means that the metric in five dimensions has a term of the form dx5 plus, let me call it c mu, dx mu, where mu is the index in four dimensions, squared plus ta-ta-ta. What it means is that there are cross terms between the metric in five dimensions and the components of the metric in four dimensions, in particular with space-like indices here. OK, so this is something like dx5 plus c1 dx1 plus et cetera squared. So what you see is that the metric in five dimensions has a gi5, where this I is a space-like index. And this is precisely ai, which is the magnetic component. The components of the gauge potential with space-like indices are the magnetic components. So there is electric magnetic charge. OK, so the fact that the S1 is non-trivially fibered around that point means that this point, when viewed from four dimensions, carries magnetic charge with respect to the gauge potential that comes from the five-dimensional metric. Any questions about that? Because this is the key point. You will see a magnetic monopole. Yeah, this is a magnetic monopole. Yeah. And the problem is, well, let's get to that in a second. But now you see where the angular momentum, Q electric and Q magnetic, where is the angular momentum coming from in four dimensions? It's coming from the fact that you have a solution with crossed electric and magnetic fields. Because this is a magnetic source and this is an electric source. So in 4D, J, in fact, you can show that takes the form 1/2 of Q electric times Q magnetic plus subleading terms, subleading in the distance between the two objects. So when this distance is large enough, the angular momentum in four dimensions takes this form, which some of you will recognize as Dirac's formula for the angular momentum of a system that has electric charge, Q electric, and magnetic charge, Q magnetic. OK, so this is just as well. It's just as well that this is a singularity here, or that there is something over here. Because if the spacetime had been smooth everywhere outside the horizon of this black hole, and there hadn't been any other horizons or singularities anywhere, again, I would have violated what I told you about the fact that there do not exist supersymmetric rotating, isolated supersymmetric rotating black holes in four dimensions. Okay? This doesn't violate that because those theorems apply to spacetimes that have only one isolated horizon and are smooth everywhere outside that horizon. So if we want to, what we can do is to remedy the presence of this singularity by hiding it behind another horizon. How do we do that? Well, all we have to do is to put now in five dimensions, consider a solution that not only has a black ring over here, but also a black hole, a spherical black hole now, over here at the origin. Because now when you reduce that solution, this black hole in five dimensions that has an S3 horizon gives you a black hole in four dimensions that has an S2 horizon. The reason for that is that the S3 is an S1 fibration over the S2. So you also get an S2. And now what we have constructed, this is the final point I wanted to get at. What we have constructed is a connection between five-dimensional black holes and black rings and four-dimensional black holes. In particular, with four-dimensional black hole solutions that carry angular momentum and are supersymmetric. And the reason why they don't violate any theorems is because you have to have at least two horizons, okay? Because the ring gives you one of them, and then to hide the singularity, you have to have another black hole over here. And the theorems don't exclude that you can have disconnected horizons. Yes? It's supersymmetric. So that is actually a very good question. In the five-dimensional setup, it's clear why these two objects don't collapse on top of each other. This one here is very happy sitting at the origin, and it would cost energy to actually move it away. Okay? If you look at the details, that's what you find. And the black ring wants to contract because it has a tension and it has gravity, but as I said, there is an angular momentum that prevents the circle from shrinking. So in five dimensions, the reason why this is supersymmetric and there is actually no force between these objects, once you take all the details into account, is essentially the physics of angular momentum. Yes? Now, from the four-dimensional point of view, it might look a little bit more surprising. But in fact, it's not so surprising, because if this system was to fall on top of that one, once they are on top of each other, there is no angular momentum. But if I tell you that there is an angular momentum to start with, because that's a conserved charge, you know that they can't fall on top of each other. They could, but this is, you know, very nonlinear supergravity. Of course, you wouldn't have guessed this solution, but you can write it down and check. It's a little bit like with a supertube. You might expect that you have to make the system rotate to stabilize it with angular momentum, but precisely the reason why you can do it with supersymmetry is that it's not really rotating. Oh, no, no, no. I'm not making any statements about what happens if you now go and kick one of them. All I'm saying is that if they are, but this is also true if you take two stacks of D brains, no angular momentum, nothing. Take two D0 brains. If they are sitting at rest with respect to each other, it's supersymmetric and there's no force. But as soon as you move one of them, there's a force. You break supersymmetry, et cetera. This is the same. Which ones? Ah, good. So, in everything I told you about here, for simplicity, I was setting all the big Qs, the Qis, to be equal, and all the little Qs to also be equal, okay? Now, what I discussed is the charges in the four-dimensional solution with respect to the four-dimensional gauge potential that comes from the metric in five dimensions. But of course, in five dimensions, there is also another gauge potential, because we started with a theory that had gravity and gauge charges. So there is also an A5, let me call it M, because M goes over the mu indices and the fifth index, gauge potential that will give you another, let's say, an A prime in four dimensions. And I did not discuss what happens with the charges of this system with respect to that gauge potential. Is that clear? So because I'm running out of time, I can tell you what happens in private if you like. But all the interesting physics comes from the gauge charges with respect to this one. Because it's with respect to that gauge potential that you have electric and magnetic charges that generate an angular momentum. The other ones don't generate one. Sorry? If they stay out? Conserved, you said? Ah, good question. Here, the little q's are conserved. And the reason, one physical way to understand that, so you can answer that at different levels, but the most physical way to understand that is that, if you remember, the reason why the little q's were not conserved is because the corresponding gauge potentials that they sourced fall off in five dimensions with one power of the distance too fast. Yes? Now what happens is that that's true when you have an asymptotically flat solution in 5D, which whose space-like surfaces at infinity are R4. So it falls off as a dipole in R4. But here, because you are compactifying the circle at infinity, they fall off slower, because the flux lines cannot spread, because there's a compact direction at infinity. So they can only spread the flux lines in R3. So remember, tau nat is R3 cross S1 at infinity. So that's one way to understand why they are now conserved. If you want a more technical answer, I can give it to you in private. It's got to do with the existence of normalizable harmonic forms on tau nat. Oh, from the 0.4 conformal field theory, there is no mystery. No microstate carries angular momentum. This was precisely my point. The microstates just don't carry that quantum number. What is actually surprising is not that the microstates don't carry it, but that the black ring carries it. And that's an effect of what happens when you take this black string and you bend it to form a circle. You have to apply a torque. It's the same that happens if you take an electric and a magnetic charge in four dimensions and you try to separate them. You have to apply a torque because you are generating angular momentum. So maybe this is a good point to stop. And if there are any more questions, I'm happy to answer all of them. But maybe some people want to leave. So thank you, everybody, for listening.